Anyone who has tuned into Saturday Night Live in the last decade will recognize Rachel Dratch immediately. A 7-year veteran of SNL, Dratch is best known for her wicked impersonation of Calista Flockhart.
Women put pressure on themselves. I want a career and a husband and children, and I want passionate sex. And I want to be small enough to sleep in an envelope.
Her lover skit with Will Ferrell.
We were wondering, is this your first time at the Welshley Arms Hotel?
Yeah.
And are you here without a lover?
Her Boston teen Sully and Denise with Jimmy Fallon.
I swear to God, Sully, if you don't get that Burger King breath out of my face, I'm gonna get wicked pissed off.
What, if I was rich, I'd eat a Whopper every day.
And especially the queen of depressing non sequiturs, Debbie Downer.
Ever since they found mad cow disease in the U.S., I'm not taking any chances. It can live in your body for years before it ravages your brain.
She has a new book out called Girl Walks Into a Bar, Comedy Calamities, Dating Disasters, and a Midlife Miracle. It is now out in paperback, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Rachel Dratch to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It is it's an absolute delight. The book came out in hardcover last year. It's now out in paperback. Has it been fun doing the round, talking about your life, your career, and sort of reflecting?
It's funny because when I wrote it, a lot of people told me, like, oh, it's so honest. And then I was, is it too honest? I don't know. But then you get asked everything again in interviews. That's a little weird because you kind of write it exactly how you want it to be. <You know?
laughs> And then you have to reinterpret it.
And you flutter and stammer when you talk about things in real life. Yeah, exactly.
Your original, and this is what I didn't know about you. This is what I found fascinating about the book. You went to Dartmouth for psychology. So the obvious question is, at what point did you think about that as a career path?
Well, also, I was actually drama and psychology, just to say that it was sort of in there already. But, you know, I always sort of just had fun doing the plays. And then at Dartmouth, I got involved in the improv comedy group. And that's where I, you know, really had the most fun doing just stuff you just make up right on the spot and everything. And then our group went out to Chicago just to sort of explore it. And that's when I decided, well, maybe I'll just move out here after college just to see. Like, I didn't expect it to work. I was sort of, it's one of those, I have to give it a shot so I know I did, and then I can move on and become a regular lady of the suburbs. But it just kept, it wasn't like I had instant success in Chicago, but it just kept being like a slow, fun climb kind of thing. And then I was sort of hooked in.
For the
gradually.
For the type of work that you wanted to do, I mean, obviously, New York has its center, Los Angeles has its center, but when it comes to this type of comedy, of improv comedy, Chicago is really the place to be, isn't it?
Yeah, well, especially back then. I mean, this was this was in the late 80s. So then Chicago was really, like, the place, which, I mean, it still is. It still has all those resources and everything. But it's just now New York has a couple improv theaters that were started by Chicago people. So there's more of a scene here, too. But back then, yeah, that was the place to go.
And you wanted to accomplish what? What did you think you could do?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I guess if I was really honest with myself, you know, Saturday Night Live was the big goal in the back of my head. But it was so crazy of a goal that I could never even voice it to myself. So I guess, like I said, the initial goal was just know that I tried, you know, so that I'm not watching movies and be like, I should have given that a shot, you know. That was the initial goal. But then as it went on, well, it's funny. A lot of people move out there wanting to be on SNL, and then you immediately drop it because you realize, wait, everyone can't get on SNL here. And then it starts becoming about getting better at improv and writing and getting on the main stage at Second City becomes a goal. So it becomes more about, dare I say, the art, you know, once you get involved in that whole community.
You talk in the book about, in the fourth grade, sort of catching on to SNL and having it be the thing that, you know, you'd stay up late to watch.
Yeah, I happened to catch it at a friend's house, like, sleeping over. Her older brother was watching it, and I was immediately hooked into it. I kind of didn't understand it, but I knew it was something super cool, and I would watch it all the time when I could as a kid. And like I said in the book, like, half the jokes went over my head, I'm sure. But there was just something about it that I was drawn to. And I dressed up as a conehead for Halloween in fourth grade. A very, very rudimentary, horrendously made costume, which was like a paper bag fashioned into a cone. And for some reason, I put white powder on my face. I don't know.
Well,
I had to have a sign. I wore a sign that said, I am a conehead, because clearly you wouldn't be able to tell that from the costume.
In the book, you have an unofficial guide, your unofficial guide to being on SNL, and it's a fascinating process, but my God, it seems arduous.
It is arduous. I mean, the funny thing is, that was actually one of the hardest parts in writing the book, because everything else was sort of a funny story with a beginning, middle, end. And then when they said, well, we want to hear more about SNL, it's like, you could talk about any aspect of it. So I just sort of decided to go with this, like, here's what it's like, you know, if you ever get on the show. and, yeah, what you don't know is, a lot of people don't know that the actors are also responsible for writing and bringing in their own characters and stuff. So, you know, there's writers there, too, but it's pretty rare that a writer comes up like, I've thought of a great character for you, like a character. Those are all mainly actor-generated. So you're always trying to think up your next big thing, and it's not as easy as it looks. I mean, when you're sitting at home, you're like, I can do that. But just come up with something that's truly original and that catches on, and that, as you'll see in the book, like, that gets on the show, because that's one of the biggest, there's a lot of hurdles along the way to getting your scene on the show.
So when you come in with a character, and from my understanding and talking to other cast members, many times you go in with a writing partner. Did you have somebody that you were working with?
Well, that's another thing. If you come into SNL and you don't have any writing experience, it's pretty hard. But at Second City and The Groundlings, the other place, like, we would write scenes in a different way. We would improvise them on stage, usually. You could have an idea, then you just go up and improvise it. But, yeah, at SNL, you're sitting in front of a computer. It's a totally different method, sort of. So it can be, yeah, there's a definite learning curve when you get there. I knew Tina. Tina was already there. We were together at Second City. So when I first got there, I wrote a lot with Tina. I mean, you can go off and write on your own. It's a little harder to do. I like working with somebody. And Tina, you know, she knew the ropes there and everything. She's a fantastic writer, obviously. So, and then as it went on, like, you kind of gel with other people, and you just find your little clique of writers that you kind of work well with.
And Tina Fey obviously then became head writer. So when you look at what is possible, when you look at the characters that then hit, do you know right away that a character is a success in the sense of it's something that will get you back on the show in a week or two?
Good question, because you think you know that. Like, you have this great character, and then you put it up at the table, and it could even get laughs at the table. I mean, sometimes, you know, your character tanks at the table. But you usually, if that happens, you have a feeling it might happen. But there's other ones, like, they do really well at the table, they get picked, they go to dress, and, like, sometimes they even do well at dress, and they still don't get on the show. Like, I mean, I had this one character, he actually made it on, but it was this guy named Abe Scheinwald. He was this old, like, 80-year-old Hollywood producer. And I tried to, so he did really well at the table, and then he even did well in the dress rehearsal, but the like last little hurdle of getting your scene on SNL is if your scene is at the end of the show, it could always get cut for time, because it really is live, and it's just an estimate. So he got cut for time like 2 times, and then it's kind of hard because you have to bring it back to the table again, get it picked again another week, and so it's just harder to do that, but it finally got on. But that was one that, like, almost didn't. And then there's other ones, like, I had this little child star character that I loved so much. The cast loved it. It was getting all these laughs. I could never get him out. The time we put him in a dress, like, something was just off about it. It got no laughs. And so, yeah, there's characters that you just love, and then, you know, no one ever sees them. That happens to everybody at the show.
You know, I've heard this, again, I've heard this from other cast members, and I always find it surprising, because you think, as the example you just gave, sounds fantastic and it sounds terrific, and okay, you don't quite understand why it didn't get on the show, but then you see some of the things that do get on the show that are just awful, and you wonder, well, how did that happen?
Well, I talk about that a little in the book, too, because I said, like, you know, your scene might kill and not get picked. And then there's another one, you're like, oh, that's not funny at all. But the thing is, someone is always thinking about that, your scene. Like, it's just a matter of taste. I mean, there's all different tastes there. And sometimes, you know, your taste doesn't win out or whatever. And there's scenes you don't even understand why they're supposed to be funny, but other people do. So that's kind of the just part of the deal there, you know. But I got to say, like, a lot of times before I was on the show, I'd be like, what is this? How'd this get on? You know, people love to criticize SNL. But sometimes, like, those kind of scenes, when you're inside on the, you know, seeing the whole process, like, that scene probably did really well at the table. And, you know, as it went on, I don't know what happened. Maybe people inside the show still think it's really funny. It's just a strange disconnect that can happen sometimes. But, like I said, people love to, you know, sit around and harsh on SNL. It's kind of a 40-year-old hobby now, so.
when you get a character like Debbie Downer that obviously hits, how does that change your status on the show?
You know, it really doesn't, because it changes your own, like, hanging on there. Like, it changes your own, okay, I did something this week,
right.
You know. But the next week you come in and you could not be in the show again, all over again. So it's not like, it's always, you're always having to reinvent yourself there. And even if you have a character that hits, you know, it feels good when you're walking down the street and people come up to you. And you feel good in terms of, you know, you got one on kind of thing. But it definitely doesn't guarantee like a year of success for you.
But it seems, and here again, that's a disconnect, because that character has become, as you mentioned, this part of this 40-year pop culture. It has become part of our culture and a character that so many of us relate to.
Yeah.
It becomes part of the
gradually lexicon.
I
know. Like, that's really cool for me. But it just happens gradually. So when you're on the show, I mean, it's weird because it kind of took off even after I've been on the show. After I've left the show. So, yeah, and also the other weird thing about Debbie Downer is nothing topped that first one where we all cracked up. So it was always a challenge to do them again in a way, because people wanted to see the character, but it was never going to be the one where we all lost it, you know? So that was a kind of unique situation to be in about that one.
Which is not something that they like you to do on that show, right? It isn't like the Carol Burnett show where that is frowned upon, isn't it?
Well, you don't really get in trouble for it, but it's definitely, I think, among all the actors now, like, it's a cheap way of getting laughs, because the audience loves when you crack up. So if you did it in every scene, you're going to get laughs, but you're kind of, like, working the system a little, you know? So I don't think anyone, you know, I think everyone tries not to laugh on the show. But if you do, you don't really get in trouble about it.
The book is Girl Walks Into a Bar, Comedy Calamities, Dating Disasters, and a Midlife Miracle. And I want to talk about the midlife miracle. At what point did you know you were ready to move on and take the next step?
Oh, from SNL, you mean?
Yes.
Well, my contract was up. I'd been there 7 years, so I knew I was either going to leave that year or the following year. And then 30 Rock happened, so then I was like, this seems like a good, you know, next step. So that sort of made me leave, I guess. And yeah, then that didn't quite go as planned. And then I was basically, you know, you kind of think SNL is going to be this big springboard, you're going to be
right,
so busy all the time. And then that didn't happen for me. So then I was sort of had a lot of time on my hands. And that's when I started, finally, I mean, a couple years later, I was kept kind of waiting for the phone to ring with that audition. You know, I mean, I keep learning again and again, like, you have to write your own thing. It's just where your own power is instead of waiting for the phone. But finally, I just started, as a more of a creative exercise, just started writing stories up. Like, well, I kind of decided now that I'm not so busy, I'm going to do the things I didn't have time for when I was. And one of those was dating, because I just always, you know, blew that off kind of, and a few other things I decided, like, oh, I had a dog for a while, I write about that too. But I started writing up those things, and then those stories kind of sat around for a while. I went to my lit agent and she liked them, but they needed kind of an arc, which they didn't have. And so then about a year later, 2 years later, I had this major life plot twist, and I also realized it could be a book plot twist too. So that's when I started writing, you know, a book.
And that's what you call in this the not showbiz part.
Yes,
of the memoir.
Not, I mean, the book is really about not showbiz. It's about post showbiz in my life. I'm still involved in showbiz, but it's about, yeah, more. I sort of give the showbiz background, and it's about other things.
And not to just so to clarify for people that may not be familiar, but you were offered the part of Jenna on 30 Rock. The pilot is shot, and they decide that they want more of an ingenue.
Yeah, exactly.
And they go with Jane Krakowski.
They go with Jane Krakowski. And actually, I mean, this is so weird because now it's 7 years ago, and it's just, like, for me, it's kind of old history, but I did start the book with this because it's kind of where whole book started in my mind. Yeah, I mean, basically, like, pilot casting changes happen all the time, and, you know, rejections happen all the time. Like, we're pretty used to them by the time you've been acting this long. What was hard about that was more that it got sort of picked up in every media thing, and it was just, like beating a dead horse. It just kept coming up over and over. Every where I'd go, you know, people would ask me about it. And if it had just kind of slipped under the radar, the actual casting change I totally got and was fine with. And I got to do the other little character parts on the show too. So yeah, that's how that went.
Is it tough that it's the people that you've worked with telling you this in the sense of that it's Lorne Michaels and Tina Fey?
Well, I guess it definitely creates some awkwardness, I suppose, but not in terms of like next time I saw Lorne, I wasn't like ducking in a corner. I mean, it's like one of those that's showbiz things, you know? So I wasn't, you know, personally, like I got it, you know, I mean, the way that the part was and the, what they needed, I got it. So it wasn't like a personal thing, but I guess that's why everyone, maybe that's why the media was in on it.
Mm.
So far. Yeah.
As you talked about the not showbiz part, is that this unexpected joy of dating and becoming a mom when you least expected it.
Yeah.
44 years old.
Yeah. Basically, so when I had all this time on my hands, I started, you know, going on all these dates. And when I say all these dates, I mean like 3 dates in the year instead of 0, basically. But to me, that was really like making an effort. And then I sort of gave up on the whole dating thing after that. Like, I have these bad dating stories in the book, and then I kind of just gave up. And then sometime after that, I was randomly in a bar with a friend and met a guy who was living in California at the time, and he's walking in, he's making faces at me right now. Okay, I'm on a radio thing right now. Okay. I was just on the phone talking to a friend.
It's a cameo. That's good. That's a cameo.
Okay, so anyway, he lived in California, and we started dating long distance.
And you're still together, apparently.
Yeah, apparently. He just walked in my apartment, so I guess so. anyway, okay, so where was I? Oh, yeah, so we were dating long distance for about 6 months, and I thought I was basically too old. I was, like, almost 44 years old, so I'd kind of let go of the whole child thing. Like, I mean, I always thought I'd wanted kids, but I wasn't someone that wanted to do it on my own. So I kind of spent a kind of a process of letting go of that idea and trying to be okay with that sort of. So anyway, then lo and behold, at age almost 44, I discovered I was pregnant and had to call him up on the phone. And we were both just completely shocked, scared, freaked. We definitely weren't, you know, like, I know sometimes someone could date for 6 months and be like, this is the one. But we weren't really like that. We were just kind of like fun, early 40s, going on trips together, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, then we had this, you know, big thing to deal with. And that's what a lot of the book is about.
And as it stands right now, you like being a mom and you like the both the not showbiz and the showbiz parts of your life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even though I was scared when I found out I was pregnant, because I didn't even know, you know, here I was like, I want to be a mom. But I didn't really think about it because it wasn't a possibility in my mind. So then here I was going to have a baby, and I was like, I have no baby experience. I haven't even held a baby probably since, like, high school babysitting or something. And I definitely had a lot of fears, which I talk about in the book, like going to register. And I didn't even know where John was going to be in the picture or anything. But yeah, it all worked out. Like, I thank my lucky stars that I was kind of given this gift, strange sort of twist in my life. Yeah.
And when it comes to a career, you talk about, you know, you hope you get something more interesting than the lesbian mutant best friend parts that you currently receive.
That's been offered, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of evened out a little bit, I guess. I don't always get offered those parts anymore, but yeah, I mean, things have kind of slowed down, but like I said, you know, I have to be a self-starter, which is what I keep realizing. I mean, some people get those phone calls, like, we want you in this movie and then that movie and that movie. Like, I'm just not in that category, so, and most people aren't, actually, so I'm just trying to write more and think up my own stuff.
Well, the book is very, very entertaining, and as are you. It is Girl Walks Into a Bar, Comedy Calamities, Dating Disasters, and Midlife Miracles. It is published by Gotham. Rachel Dratch, what a pleasure having you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Girl Walks Into a Bar. It's published by Gotham. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
I had a mole looked at recently, and the doctor told me that due to the extent of its irregular borders, I'm flirting with a melanoma. You never did catch that anthrax guy.